The time is now. Hey everybody, this is Volume 1, Episode 8, Employment Law Now, and I'm Mike Schmidt from Cozen O'Connor. Thanks so much for listening again, and I really do have to thank all of you who have been giving me some great feedback and sending me some really nice messages about the first 7 episodes that we've done. Keep the feedback coming, keep the comments coming. I am definitely listening. In addition to some nice comments about what you've been hearing and how you've been hearing it, I've also been getting some great suggestions. People have said, I'd love to hear about this particular issue. Some folks have said, I'd love to hear some future episode on the FMLA and some recent developments under the FMLA. And some other people have said, well, let's talk a little bit about independent contractor classifications and misclassifications when it comes to wage and hour issues. Some folks have told me, can we hear some things about background checks and what the EEOC has in store for its agenda moving forward? So again, I'm definitely listening to you, and my future episodes of this podcast are going to be responsive. We will be dealing with a lot of the topics that you've been asking me about, and we'll also continue to bring in some outside guests. You have heard and hopefully enjoyed, for example, the NLRB General Counsel Richard Griffin a couple of episodes ago. We're going to try to be bringing in some more government agency representatives to give you a little bit insight into what they're thinking from the agency perspective and some practical tips from the agency perspective as to how employers can work toward complying with these myriad of employment laws. So again, thanks so much for sending in the comments. We've got a nice episode today. I've got a few cases that I want to bring to your attention and some trends in the employment law world. And then we're going to play a real fun game of prognostication. We're going to talk about a few issues and look into our crystal ball and figure out whether the particular issue is going to stay or whether the particular issue is going to go as we move into 2017 and beyond. So let's get started with our first segment, the DC Update Now segment. And we've been hearing a lot over the last few weeks and certainly over the last few episodes about the Department of Labor and the new chairman of the new head of the Department of Labor being confirmed by Congress. Well, the NLRB has also just made some news. President Trump has appointed Philip Miscamara as the new chairman of the NLRB. Mr. Miscamara has been a board member at the NLRB for about 4 years, since August 7, 2013, and he was the acting chairman of the NLRB since just this past January 23rd. We think that as President Trump continues to appoint not only the new chairman of the NLRB, but gets to fill some vacancies with the NLRB, that we're certainly going to be seeing a much more pro-employer NLRB. We think that the agenda of the NLRB going forward will probably dial back a lot of the pro-employee stances that we've seen and, frankly, that we heard about from Richard Griffin a couple of episodes ago. But as I've also said, it's going to take some time. Unlike the Department of Labor and maybe some other agencies, the NLRB, because of its staggered seating on the board, it's going to take a little bit of time to really make this fully a Republican board, fully a pro-employer board. So while this is certainly a good start and a good step forward from the employer side of things, it is going to take more than just a couple of weeks and more than a couple of months before we really start to see some differences in the NLRB's agenda and initiatives. But that's the DC update for now. Let's move on to our noteworthy now segment. And here I've got three cases that I really want to talk to you about because I think that they are not only interesting cases, but I do think that they will impact and should impact your company's policies and how you go about dealing with the issue of communicating a certain corporate culture to your managers and to the entire organization. First deals with the transgender issue that we've been hearing so much about and seeing so much about. It's a case called Christensen versus Omnicom Group. It's out of the Second Circuit. Christensen versus Omnicom Group is the case name, again, for those keeping score at home. The Seventh Circuit Court of Appeals recently became the first federal appellate court to rule that sexual orientation is in fact covered under Title VII and the Title VII ban of sex discrimination. Traditionally, when you had your prohibition under Title VII for sex discrimination, you typically included normal gender discrimination, harassment, sexual harassment, those kinds of things, but courts have been reluctant to extend the protections to sexual orientation. Well, the Seventh Circuit recently became, as I said, the first federal appellate court to expand the scope of sex discrimination to include sexual orientation. And in this Christensen case, the Second Circuit, dealing with an appeal that is now pending, is really being asked to do the same thing that the Seventh Circuit just did. And it's being asked to overturn a smaller three-judge Second Circuit panel that rejected an employee's claim that the company committed sexual discrimination because it allowed a supervisor to harass him because he is gay. His claim is that sexual orientation should be protected under Title VII's ban, and now the Second Circuit Court of Appeals on appeal is likely going to decide that issue. If you haven't already, from a practical takeaway standpoint, you might consider adding sexual orientation as a protected class in your handbooks, in your policy manuals, and certainly in your training. As we like to tell companies all the time, number one, simply because it may not be a protected class under federal law for Title VII purposes in your particular jurisdiction, so many states and cities are and have added sexual orientation as a protected class under those local statutes, so it may be protected in your jurisdiction regardless of what federal law might cover or not cover in your jurisdiction. But secondly, what we also tell companies when we're doing training in 2017, it's not just about sexual harassment as the only issue that you really should be thinking about. It's really cultural sensitivity and diversity and inclusion and a much broader type of mindset that companies really should develop when it comes to training and communicating with their employees as to the type of workplace that you're really looking to have for your company. So again, it's going to be an interesting case. It'll be interesting to see if the Second Circuit really follows the Seventh Circuit in including sexual orientation as a protected class. But my takeaway is it probably is covered under your state or local law. And even if it's not, it may be something that you think about doing simply as a right thing to do from a training perspective. The next noteworthy now case that I want to talk about is in the disability area. It's interesting to think about disability cases because most of the time companies view these cases as involving employees or applicants who are actually disabled. They have some sort of medical condition that rises to the level of a disability. But it's important to understand in this area of the law that we're not just talking about people who have actual disabilities, but we're also including under the definition of the federal law, the Americans with Disabilities Act, you're also covering employees who are regarded as disabled, even if they may not actually be disabled. And part of the reason for that is because the law wants to eradicate companies engaging in stereotypical behavior, acting based on stereotypes, acting based on preconceived notions of what employees can and can't do. So individuals who claim to be regarded as disabled are also protected under the Americans with Disabilities Act. And the EEOC just recently filed a lawsuit against a massage parlor in federal court in Tampa. The name of the case, again, for those keeping score at home, it's the EEOC versus Massage Envy. And it really highlights this regarded as principle that I'm talking about. The claim here by the EEOC is that this massage parlor franchisor fired an employee who planned to travel to Ghana. Planned to travel to Ghana because the employer feared that the employee would carry the Ebola virus back to the United States. So again, think about what we're talking about here. This particular employee did not necessarily have any kind of disability. Certainly didn't have any kind of disability at the moment, but the company regarded her as, I guess, potentially being disabled because the company feared that when she was traveling to Ghana, she would be coming back and bringing the Ebola virus back from Ghana. And what the EEOC alleged in its lawsuit is that the company regarded her as disabled based on an unfounded belief about Ebola in Ghana and the risk that she would contract the virus and bring it back to the United States. So, again, what's noteworthy to me about this case is that when you're thinking about disability issues and you're thinking about who is going to be protected under these potential laws and what can you do and can't do, you need to keep in mind that it's not just those who have the textbook, the classic kind of disabilities, but it's also about the mindset that you have as an employer, and are you taking action because of some stereotype, because of some preconceived notion where you end up regarding some individual as disabled when they may not be? So that's that case, and we will certainly follow that as well as we're interested in what the outcome is going to be. The third noteworthy now case that I want to talk about brings us back to the harassment area, and this is a case that's also pending in the Second Circuit Court of Appeals. The name of the case is Daniel versus T&M Protection Resources. Typically, when you think about and when you hear about harassment cases, you typically are hearing about offending conduct that is pervasive, that is happening with some frequency and some regularity. But in some situations, a single incident may be considered severe enough that it can constitute a harassment claim. There have been exceptions to the pervasive rule. So, for example, a sexual assault or a non-sexual assault, even one time, has risen to the level of potentially unlawful harassment in some cases. But in this case, in the Daniel versus T&M Protection Resources case, the Second Circuit found that the single one-time racial epithet that was used in this case, the N-word, was enough. The fact that it was only used one time, the fact that there was no regular use, no frequent use, was irrelevant. That because the N-word is so significant and so meaningful and powerful from a negative standpoint, the single one-time use of it could be enough to rise to the level of inappropriate harassment. The court here in this case hasn't yet ruled on the ultimate liability question, and that is whether the company would be liable for a supervisor making that one-time single comment. What the court did do, however, is say that the one-time use of that kind of word by itself could support a racial harassment claim. And that brings us to our Trending Now segment, and I want to stay in the harassment arena because another interesting point that I think you all need to consider from a mindset standpoint, two of the three noteworthy cases that I just mentioned deal with harassment, but not necessarily sexual harassment. Remember, the Christensen case dealt with the transgender and the sexual orientation issue, and in that case, you were dealing with sexual orientation harassment. The Daniel versus T&M case that I just went through dealt with a racial harassment issue. And what I find is that so many employers, whether it's in their handbooks, whether it's in their training, whether it's in their corporate mindset, they think of harassment as being only a sexual harassment issue. And by no means am I suggesting that sexual harassment is not an issue that is still prevalent in many walks of life in many companies, nor am I suggesting that employers should not be taking sexual harassment seriously still. What I am suggesting is that from a mindset standpoint, you really need to be thinking about the concept of harassment as being one that's broader than just sexual harassment. So so you could have harassment based on really any protected class: age harassment, race harassment, disability harassment, national origin harassment, religious harassment. And as we've all seen, we see the comments on Facebook, we see the tweets, we hear the water cooler comments, whether it's related to President Trump and some of his initiatives and policies, or whether it's just the way of the world and what's going on in the world, we've seen such an uptick in harassment claims based on religion, based on national origin, that companies really need to understand that those types of harassment claims have to be taken seriously and have to be addressed in the same way that the traditional sexual harassment claims have been treated by the organizations. But sticking with the sexual harassment part for one more second, I probably shouldn't go any further without mentioning the Bill O'Reilly and the Fox News issue, which you all have undoubtedly heard about and read about as well. And people ask me about the Bill O'Reilly thing all the time. And I certainly wasn't there, and I certainly am not going to purport to know what the facts are, what happened, what didn't happen. But I think that there are a few takeaways, again, from the corporate mindset standpoint, that you really should consider when thinking about how this Bill O'Reilly issue came about, and ultimately Fox News terminating Bill O'Reilly's employment. A couple of takeaways here. First, you need to understand from a corporate mindset standpoint that there cannot be different rules for your star performers, for your top producers. We see it in almost every industry, particularly in a sales-oriented business, but not exclusive to that. Most companies have their star performers, their top producers, and you need to make sure that your rules against harassment, discrimination, and unlawful workplace conduct applies to and is enforced against even your star performers and top producers. Secondly, the culture really has to start at the top. It has to start at the top from a mindset standpoint. If you have your senior executives, your C-suite people, who are not buying in to this cultural sensitivity mindset, to the anti-harassment, anti-discrimination mindset, it's really hard to expect the lower-level employees, those in the trenches performing the day-to-day job duties, it's really hard to expect that they are going to adopt this cultural sensitivity mindset. So it really has to start at the top. Your communications, your policies, your training really has to be incorporated to involve your C-suite people, your senior executive, senior management of your company, so that it can trickle down from them and the lower level employees will understand what your corporate culture and mindset should be and will be because it's been adopted at the highest level. And then I guess the third and last lesson that I would take away from the Bill O'Reilly situation, you really have to have an appropriate and effective complaint procedure. It's not enough to simply put something in writing, put it in your handbook, and then stick it in a drawer that lays out what your complaint procedure is going to be. It has to be appropriate, and it has to be effective. And there's not a one-size-fits-all when it comes to complaint procedures. There may be some unique aspects to your particular company, your particular industry, maybe even your particular workforce, but you have to give some thought to all of those factors and develop an appropriate complaint procedure that will be effective to accomplish the purpose of the complaint procedure, and that is to allow the company to know about issues when they arise and to have an opportunity to investigate and do something where appropriate. So from the trending now standpoint, I want you to take away from this discussion, at a minimum, that you have to develop a mindset where you understand that harassment, sure, sexual harassment is critical and important, but that it's even broader than just sexual harassment. Harassment can be based on any protected class, and you need to make sure you have clear, consistent policies that apply to everybody equally in your company, from the top to the bottom and side to side. That's your Trending Now segment. It's time at this point to play a little bit of a game, and I've really been looking forward to this one because I think it's going to be fun. It's going to shake things up a little bit. We're going to play prognostication in this segment, and I'm going to call this one, Should We Stay or Should We Go? Yeah. love that. Should I stay or should I go? So I'm going to go through a few issues here and talk a little bit about my thoughts on whether this particular issue or this particular law is going to be staying around for some time or whether I think it's going to be going. So the first one, we know that private employers, when it comes to overtime work by the employees, private employers, as of now, have to actually pay money, pay cash, for the overtime worked at time and a half. Is that rule going to be staying, or is that rule going to be going? Well, we think there's a chance that it might be going. There's been, over the last, 5 to 7 years, all kinds of initiatives, particularly in Washington, to try to change the law. You've all heard about the overtime rules and the job duties tests and the salary tests, all kinds of attempts to change those. But running a little bit under the radar is this issue about whether we can offer comp time in lieu of time and a half from a cash payment standpoint to pay for overtime worked when an employee works over 40 hours in a week. Certain kinds of public entities have been allowed to do that, but on the private sector side, private employers to date have not been allowed to provide comp time in lieu of paying cash for working over 40 hours in a week. However, the House of Representatives in Congress just passed the Working Families Flexibility Act. That act would permit paid time off as an alternative in the private sector to paying time and a half wages for overtime. Now, the devil is always in the details, like with everything. You're going to cap your leave hours if the bill in this form does in fact pass. You will be capped at the leave hours that you are allowed to be provided at 160 for the calendar year. Significantly, this is a voluntary thing on the employee's part, so you're only allowed to provide the comp time in lieu of cash if the employee wants to do it. The employer can't force the employee to take that alternative. And there are a couple of other sort of devil in the details that are in this bill, but it is significant that it just passed the House. And it now is going to be debated by the Senate. Of course, Democrats largely oppose this because unions and other pro-employee, certainly pro-employee organizations, have largely opposed this. So it's not clear whether the Senate will in fact pass the bill that passed the House, whether the Senate would try to rewrite the bill and come up with its own version of this, or whether it's just going to die on the floor and nothing will come out of this. But there are some indications that some bill, some version of a bill allowing for paid time off in lieu of cash time and a half might survive and might come out of the House and the Senate together and be presented to President Trump for signature at some point. So, the next one, paid sick leave laws. Paid sick leave laws. Is that something that is going to stay or go? Well, we think that's certainly going to be here for a little while. That's going to stay. That's the right answer. Counties, cities, states, even the federal government are continuing to propose and enact paid sick leave laws. There are a whole host of states that are already paid that have already enacted paid sick leave laws: Arizona, California, Connecticut, Massachusetts, Oregon, Vermont, Washington. They've already passed paid sick leave laws. New York is a state where there's a proposal that'll be up next year. Maryland, Michigan, Nevada, and New Jersey are currently considering paid sick leave proposals. Certain cities have also enacted this, Minneapolis and Chicago, which is going to go into effect this summer. We don't think this is going to go away, so we think the issue of paid sick leave laws will be staying around for a while. So you need to look at this depending on what jurisdiction you're in, and if there is a law in place in your jurisdiction, you really need to figure out who's covered, what are the permissible leave uses under these laws, what are the accrual and the carryover rules, what kind of notice obligations are on the company side and the employee side. So paid sick leave laws, we think, are here to stay. When it comes to handbooks and the freedom to say whatever you want in handbooks, is that going to stay or is that going to go? We think handbook freedom is going to go. Now, handbooks and the ability to have handbooks is not going to go away in general, but some of the policies and some of the typical language that you have in your handbooks are going to go away. When you're, for example, having a policy allowing a criminal history check before someone gets a criminal, before somebody gets a conditional job offer, in most jurisdictions, you're not going to be able to do that because of what's referred to as ban the box legislation. So you want to make sure in your jurisdiction that you are, number one, able to do a criminal history check. And if you are, at what stage of the application process are you able to do it? And what are you allowed to rely on from either a temporal standpoint or a subject matter connection standpoint to the particular job that's being applied for? Salary history requests also are going by the wayside. So many jurisdictions, New York is one of the more recent ones, but so many jurisdictions have now banned companies from asking about salary history as a matter of policy. So for those of you who have in your application or in your handbooks a policy that requires applicants to disclose a prior salary history, you're not going to be able to do that anymore. Similarly, those who have either social media policies or other types of policies in their handbooks that require employees to be respectful to their supervisors, not to be discourteous. As we've talked about before and as we will continue to talk in future episodes, the current version of the NLRB has frowned upon those types of vague and ambiguous handbook and policy statements as really chilling the potential exercise of the rights that employees have under federal law to engage in concerted activity for their mutual aid and protection. So the next one, what about the current changes, the proposed changes from last Thanksgiving to the overtime job duties? Well, we think that's going to go. The government has just asked for and received a third extension of time to file their brief. So their brief now is due on June 30th, 2017. And remember, this whole overtime rule was stayed by a federal court. We now have the new Trump administration. We now have the new Department of Labor head who is in place and who is likely to be much more aligned with President Trump and the Republican pro-employer stance. So it's really not likely that the job duties test, as the Department of Labor proposed last year, is going to be staying around in its current form. Do we think that there will be some changes made eventually? We do. Does that mean that the salary levels will increase, the minimum salary threshold will increase? We think that'll happen, probably not to the levels that were proposed last year. We think there will be some increase, but if you're asking me whether the proposed DOL changes from last year are likely to be going or staying, I think it's safe to say that they are going to be going. What about class actions? We hear a lot about class actions, and many argue that class actions have very liberal standards and it's much easier to certify class actions these days. What about the class action liberal standards? Are those going to be staying or are those going to be going? Well, I think the consensus is that when the issue reaches the Supreme Court, and now that we have the new nominated justice of the Supreme Court on this issue potentially, there's a real likelihood that the liberal standards that have been applied to class actions and class action certification motions will likely go by the wayside as well. Staying with the class action issue is this class action waiver issue. We've heard a lot about that as well, where companies want to try to put arbitration provisions in their agreements, forcing employees to arbitrate their disputes, and they put in those class action waivers, which mean that an employee or a group of employees cannot bring a class action within the framework of the arbitration. They have to go individually through arbitration to resolve their disputes. You are waiving the right to have a class action. Well, the NLRB and now a couple of appellate courts have taken the position that a class action waiver violates the NLRA, and again, that right to engage in protected concerted activity by employees. So what do we think now? Do we think class action waivers are going to stay around, or are they going to go? We think class action waivers are probably going to stay around. Once again, with Justice Gorsuch on the Supreme Court, he will likely have a very pivotal view on this issue in the cases that are coming up in the next term for the Supreme Court, and there's a very good likelihood that the Supreme Court will give its blessing to class action waivers. And lastly, is the issue of EEOC lawsuits. I just mentioned one EEOC lawsuit in my Noteworthy Now segment, but EEOC lawsuits generally. So many people think that the EEOC is really overreaching and spending a lot of time and money bringing their own cases as opposed to an individual employee or group of employees bringing these cases. People think that the EEOC is spending too much time bringing their own lawsuits. So do we think that this notion of EEOC lawsuits is going to stay, or is it going to go? What do we think? Well, EEOC lawsuits and the frequency of them are likely going to stay. The acting chair of the EEOC, Victoria Lipnick, had recently said that the EEOC, in her opinion, filed too few lawsuits last year in 2016. So when you're looking at the EEOC's agenda, it seems that at least from the acting chair's perspective, the EEOC needs to be stepping up and ramping up their efforts to bring lawsuits that match their strategic agenda and strategic initiatives to eradicate certain kinds of discrimination. So I hope you enjoyed that game of should I stay or should I go? All right, enough of that. You heard that already. I do hope you enjoyed that, and we'll play some more of that in future episodes as well as we really navigate 2017 and get to know a little bit more about what this Trump administration is going to be doing, not going to be doing, what the federal agencies and some of these courts are going to be doing. It's really a lot of reading tea leaves and trying to speculate and make educated guesses as to what's going to be going on with these employment laws. So as I say all the time, it's so critical, whatever your source, whether it's this podcast or not, reading alerts and treatises and bulletins and watching webinars, it's so critical for all of you out there, whether you're an in-house counsel, a human resources professional, to stay abreast of these things because, as you know, everything is changing so quickly, almost on a daily basis. So that's it for today's episode. I hope you enjoyed it. I hope you found some of this informative. I don't really like to do too much of a tease about the next episode that I'm going to be doing, but in this case, I thought it's worth a mention. One of the other issues that we've been reading a lot about, hearing a lot about, at least I have, is this notion of artificial intelligence. Artificial intelligence, and it's referred to as AI in short. And what does artificial intelligence mean? And what does it particularly mean in the law world, in the employment law world, for in-house lawyers, for human resources professionals? Well, in the next episode, which will be in the beginning of June, I'm going to be speaking with an expert who deals with artificial intelligence issues all the time. His name is Dennis Kennedy, and he's going to be coming on the podcast and answering two really important questions for us. Number one, what is artificial intelligence? And number two, should HR professionals and in-house counsel look at artificial intelligence as a potential replacement or as something that complements the kind of work you're doing on a day-to-day basis? So there's the tease. If you have no other reason to look forward to my next episode, that will be it. So thanks again so much for listening. Thanks so much again for all the great feedback that I keep getting. I hope you're finding this informative, useful, and maybe even a little bit entertaining. And until the next episode, I hope all of your labor is productive.